to take this opportunity to do a little preaching today, and I won't show too much hard research. This is some of my personal views over having dealt with conservation tillage for about the last 22 years or so. And I want to give an overview of the status of it in the Cotton Belt and maybe where we're going in the future or what we need to do to promote it in the future. What I did was contact people in all the states that grow cotton in the West, the Southwest, Mid-South, and the Southeast. Contacted University Extension people, researchers, as well as NRCS people. And I did a little survey, had them answer some questions, got maybe about a 50%, 60% response. It's kind of interesting that the states that I didn't get a response from are also the ones that had the lowest amount of conservation tillage. I'm going to compare this adoption rate to the only other two known sources that I have for statistics about what is the percentage of adoption rate of cotton in the U.S. That's from the one that was a survey done in 2004 by the Conservation Technology Information Center. That's up in Purdue, Illinois. And then the Cotton Foundation survey, which was commissioned to Doane Marketing in 2002. You can see in the Mid-South, we have roughly maybe 30% adoption if you just kind of average those three surveys. And in the Southeast, we had the highest rate of adoption. That's probably because we had the poorest soils. And research has shown over and over again that you get the biggest response to conservation tillage on the poorest, most drought-prone soils. You go to the Southwest, Texas, High Plains of Texas, you have probably about 14, 15% adoption. Some of the estimates went as high as 20. Some of them went down about as low as 13 or 12. The West, I can say that the East, regardless, is much, much better than the West. California and Arizona lag very, very badly in conservation tillage. They have less than 1% adoption of conservation tillage in California. So let's see what these incentives, when I asked these people to reply to these questions, I asked them what do they think the top three things, why growers are adopting conservation tillage. And in the West, let's take it belt to the section by section in the belt, in the Cotton Belt. The Western Belt with less than 1% adoption, the reasons that were listed most often was EQIP money, NRCS program money, to tackle water quality issues, soil quality issues, and air quality issues, especially air quality issues. Not only does NRCS throwing money at air quality issues in the West, but there's a lot of state and federal regulations that for air quality that's really driving the adoption of conservation tillage. What they consider conservation tillage is maybe making 8 trips through the field rather than 12 or 14. But this every trip makes dust, and so they have to get the PM10 and the dust down. So that's one of the drivers. Cutting the cost, fuel and labor. Some of the growers that are doing this are doing it for this reason, and this is a reason you're going to see that goes common across all regions in the belt. And profitability, another reason that is used across the belt, why producers are adopting conservation tillage. What are the impediments to adoption? In the survey, the responses were lack of information. That means that we have to do a better job as extension agents, as researchers, and as NRCS employees, we have to do a better job of getting this information to the producers. Primarily, the main reason that came back over and over and over again, and this has not changed since 20 years ago, that's risk aversion and resistance to change. And that's a natural human condition, and it's a psychological thing, and it can't be solved by all the research and extension in the world. Surface irrigation difficulties. A lot of this is flood irrigated, flat land, laser level, and traditional, if you have residue out there in that field, that's going to interfere with the flow of the water. So that's a legitimate reason for why they have such a poor rate of adoption. It can be overcome with subsurface drip, but they don't have the capital investment or the need right now to make that switch. Of course, they also have the issue with the pink bollworm control program, where they have to plow down. And a lack of equipment. This is a catch-22 thing. This is just like any time we try to grow a new crop. In order to grow a new crop, you've got to have a market established for it. And the people that have the market or that's going to develop the market won't pay you for one because they don't have a stable supply of the new crop. And the same thing with the lack of equipment. If you have an area that's only 1% adoption rate, they're not going to have this access to the same kind of equipment that we have in the southeast here, where we have anywhere from a 30 to 60% adoption rate. Let's move over to the southwestern belt with approximately, say, 14% adoption. Cutting costs, labor, fuel, and equipment. Again, that's coming up. Time management, efficiency. Large-scale farms that can do more acres in less time. Profitability, the same standard that goes across all the regions. The adoption impediments of the southwestern belt. Equipment cost. It does cost money to adopt equipment. You can get it back very, very quickly, but that's still a capital investment right up front to modify the equipment. Risk aversion, resistance to change. Perceived problems with weed management. Notice I say perceived. I've done research, others have done research that shows consistently that it's easier to control weeds in a properly managed conservation tillage system than it is where you have a clean till system. Any weed scientists in this audience? An interesting thing I'll bring up later is the lack of partnering. Now, we have a whole session of weed scientists in here, and the thing that they're going on about the whole session is Palmer amaranth resistance. There might be two papers out of the whole 20 in there that don't deal with Palmer amaranth. 15, 12 years ago, every session was about Roundup Ready trials all across the Cotton Belt, and there was nothing new. So we cannot solve these kind of problems if we don't interact. If we don't attend those sessions to learn how to control Palmer amaranth and conservation tillage, and if they don't come in here and learn how conservation tillage can help them control Palmer amaranth, we've got a problem. Perceived compaction problems. If you do have compaction in no-till, it can easily be solved, and it can be solved easier in no-till than it can be in conventional tillage. Conventional till soils will recompact worse than a no-till situation. No-till also allows for controlled traffic a lot easier. Cover crop water use is probably the biggest thing, the real problem that you have to manage in the Southwest if you want to adopt conservation tillage. Time constraints. Cover crop planting takes time. Short growing season on the high plains, this is an issue. Adoption incentives, moving to the Mid-South. 32% adoption rate. I've been in the Mid-South quite a bit, and I think that number's a little bit high. But we'll give the benefit of the doubt and say they do have a 32% adoption rate in the Mid-South. The reasons they're adopting it is cutting costs, labor, fuel, and equipment. Time management. Fairly large farms, they can get in and they can plant earlier because they don't have to spend as many operations getting the land ready to plant. The first time that anyone mentioned herbicide-tolerant cotton varieties, notice that this is a region that has 30-something percent adoption rate as opposed to less than 1 and less than 14. So this region has using it enough, the practice enough, to say that one of the reasons they're swapping is because of the herbicide-tolerant, the Roundup Ready cotton. The adoption impediments, risk aversion, resistance to change again. Perceived weed management. I'd say going through the Mid-South, my own personal view just from windshield tours is they have a bigger weed problem than we have in the Southeast. So that's a real issue. Perceived cost to transition. It does cost to transition, but it can be minimized with careful management and doing your homework. And also you can get that money back again with higher yields and lower input cost. Irrigation management difficulties, where they have large fields and still using flood irrigation. Over the Southeast, the region that I spent most of my career trying to promote conservation tillage in, on these especially sandy coastal plain soils, which do have definite compaction problems. Cutting costs, labor, fuel, and equipment costs, number one. Time management, they can get in there and plant earlier. That sometimes works to our disadvantage because they want to plant too early when might have been early enough to get away with it planting with conventional tillage when you've got a warmer soil. Going to go to no-till, one of the things they have to learn is that you have to wait another 7 to 10 days and test the soil temperature. It's not too many growers that actually go out there and take a soil thermometer and test the soil temperature and wait till it's 65 degrees before they plant cotton. Herbicide tolerant GMOs, Roundup Ready cotton was another reason that was brought out. So the two, the Mid-South and Southeast, are the two only two regions that are bringing out Roundup Ready cotton as a means for an adoption incentive, why they're doing it so much in their in those areas. The impediments: risk aversion, resistance to change. Perceived weed management, especially now with the issue with Palmer amaranth. This is a real threat to conservation tillage, setting back conservation tillage probably 20 years if we don't tackle this thing with this Palmer amaranth resistance in the Southeast, in the Mid-South. Perceived cost to transition, again, I think with proper education and the knowledge, the lack of information is not there. If we can make that available to the producers, we can help them out with that. And in Georgia, which I've lived in Alabama and worked at Auburn and also been over there and worked with a lot of people. I've worked both with Charlie and with Glenn, and I'm proud to say that Alabama's got double the rate of adoption of conservation tillage than Georgia has. And the main reason is because Georgia's got about, what, half of their crop is irrigated. And we only have about 15% irrigation, I believe, Charlie, in Alabama. So the dry land people have really moved to conservation tillage in Georgia. The center pivots don't do it, and that's because the irrigation, the responses they get from the water, which they still can pay for cheaply, is kind of buffers the need or the benefit that they get from adopting conservation tillage. So you don't have to take that risk or that resistance to change there. Now, if we look forward, I'm gonna make a little projections and some of the reasons why I think that we will see some increase in conservation tillage in the next few years. And these are some of the drivers that I think that will promote adoption. One is the changes in the Farm Bill conservation provisions. They've been strengthened in this Farm Bill, and there's some EQIP money out there. $37 million goes out to the western states. $38 million EQIP dollars is gonna be supposedly going to the Southwest, $31 million to the Mid-South, and about $30 million to the Southeast. That's not counting Conservation Security Program money. The other thing is, still that's going to drive it is the herbicide tolerant resistant varieties. As you can see the growth, this graph is from some data by Fernandez, Cornillo, and McBride, and it shows the growth in blue of herbicide tolerant cotton, the adoption rate of that, and in green here in the middle is your BT cotton. That's new varieties are coming out resistant to new different herbicides. And so that's going to continue to be a driver for conservation tillage. It's also a two-edged sword. Constant reliance on it is going to create problems with conservation tillage. I'll talk about that in a second. But another thing is, I know the cotton industry has been very proactive in doing a very good job in kind of pinning themselves as a green product. It's a sustainable product. And they've done a good job of educating the American public about this. It's going to get a little, I think they're going to go even notch it up a little bit and go to eco certification for marketing programs. The public can identify with issues like greenhouse gases and global warming. They can identify with soil quality, carbon sequestration. Notice that's a coastal plain soil that had been in conservation tillage for, I think, 6 years. You can actually see the increase in organic matter in about the top inch of soil right there. Erosion control, water quality issues. These things can be used to promote cotton as a sustainable and as a green product to the American public and the buyer. There will be new farm programs. There will be changes. You know, hope and change. It's coming sooner or later. It happened to the peanuts folks, and it's going to happen to cotton one of these days. And I think those things will move more towards funding money for conservation programs and less from direct commodity supports. The adoption impediments in the future as to why maybe things might slow down. Lack of vision and goal setting. In Brazil, where they have 90% adoption of conservation tillage, in Brazil, one of our major competitors, not only for cotton, but for wheat, soybean, and cattle, they will take the state, Sao Paulo State, the governor of the state will say, he'll get with his farm advisors and his Department of Ag, he'll get with the mayors and municipalities, And they will come up and say, we are going to have a target, say 75% conservation tillage in this state in 3 years. And they bring in the chemical companies and work with them. And in 3 years, they've all worked together and they've reached that goal. Sometimes in 2 years, they reach it. We don't have that kind of partnership. We don't have that kind of goal setting and vision here in the States, I don't believe. A lack of leadership. See, I retired last Friday, so I can say this bluntly. I work for the federal government and I've worked real close with the state universities. And I can go right a mile from my house and see University of Georgia substation. No conservation tillage on it. And we can't be promoting something if we're not doing it ourselves. The farm, the 1,200 acre research farm that I managed up until Friday, we tried to make it a model farm. Everything that a farmer had to do to qualify for tier one of the conservation security program, we did. Because if somebody was going to set foot on that farm to look at one of our research plots, we didn't want to be held accountable for saying, why in the heck you don't have a grass waterway right there? Why are you letting the cattle drink out of the pond and defecate in the stream? Why are you not using conservation tillage? This goes right to the top, to the deans. I don't understand why we don't have variety trials that are done with conservation tillage. And we don't need to do it. The other thing, we got to get past saying we'll have to double and we'll have to do the variety trials, conservation tillage and conventional tillage. Why? We're past that. We need to do it all in conservation tillage. If a variety does well in conservation tillage with the cooler, wetter soils, it's certainly going to do well in conventional tillage. A lack of partnering. This is both a psychological issue and a regulatory issue. With all the regulations that our federal government puts on us, we don't have the luxury of partnering like, to say, they do in Brazil, where they have the chemical companies get together with the states and the municipal people, with the farmer organizations, and with the universities, and with ARS equivalent, and they can partner together to set a goal and to reach it. And we've got too many ethics laws and things like that that kind of prevent us from doing that. And an example of that right now is we compartmentalize even our research. We need to be over there listening right now to what's going on with the weed science people. Are they IPM people? And we can't do that. Just the even way we set up our meetings, we compartmentalize rather than partner. Economic drivers, frankly, when we get a crisis, we'll see an increase in conservation tillage. If fuel prices go up, you're going to see an increase in adoption of conservation tillage. Another thing I want to wind it up with, the commonalities are big picture items that are keys to any successful conservation tillage program. Any conservation system that is a success has got to be, like Paul Fishman was saying, it's got to be tailor-made. It's got to be site-specific. And today we have to use site-specific technologies and conservation tillage together. It's a system approach. It's like a giant balloon. If you change one thing, it's going to change something else. That balloon's going to bulge out. It's going to be an unintended consequence someplace. If you pick a variety that's got a high yield potential, but it has a low vigor, and you plant it in that cool, wet soil, you're going to have a problem. If you don't manage the water right, and you don't understand that a cover crop is going to use water in the spring, and you could get into a problem with trying to plant to a too dry seed bed, but it will save you water later on and more than make up for it. Or if you have to balance irrigation versus residue that's going to interfere with the flood irrigation, then that's an issue. Your fertility programs, like Glenn was talking about, and Charlie, it's going to change. Nitrogen is going to change. You've got to be more cognizant of urea volatilization. You're going to do one good thing by you're going to bury the urea with a coulter, then you're going to interfere with residue, and that's going to interfere with the equipment. It's not easy. You have to be a better manager, and you've got to understand that it's complex. Another successful key to conservation tillage is residues, and that's, to me, that's something I had to learn the hard way by visiting Brazil in 1993. I'd worked for about maybe 12 years on no-till without ever having this epiphany. And it's that soil carbon and crop residues, those are the key. that make conservation tillage work. It's not the lack of tillage per se, but it's the production and the conservation of crop residues which gives us the most benefit to our productivity. Now, having said that, you still have to go back to what Paul was talking about. You've got to manage site specifically. This is kind of a stylized surface response graph of the need for crop residues according to the climate. If you were here in the Southeast, if you're in Alabama and you're in Georgia or Florida or Mississippi, Louisiana, you're in a wet, hot climate. You're at the top right top of that response curve. You need a lot of residues in order to sustain that soil resource. If you are in the high plains of Texas and you're down here and it's dry and you're hot, relatively cool in the wintertime, then you don't have the need for that much residue. If you are moderately temperature-wise and wet, then you got a moderate need for residue. If you're up trying to grow wheat up in the northern plains in Canada and it's very cold and dry, you don't hardly need any residues at all. If you're on Prince Edward Island trying to grow potatoes and it's wet and cold, residue is going to be a problem. You also got to have the proper equipment. And I'll put this up here just to show you that this is for something that was developed for small farmers to promote conservation tillage or no-till and heavy residue in Brazil with animal-driven for people that were very poor, an animal-driven no-till planter. And we had the proper equipment. We've had to kind of learn how to develop it over the last 20 years, but we've had good ag engineers. And probably most of the advances in no-till equipment have been developed by a farmer. And then all we did as researchers was copy them. This is something that all farmers that are successful at no-till or conservation tillage have to do, and they finally realize they have to manage year-round. They can't make a decision just during the cotton season, growing season, and then go down to the Redneck Riviera in Panama City and spend the winter. They have to worry about when they start harvesting that crop. If they go and mow that stalk too short, it's going to be stick up and it's going to punch holes in their tires the next spring when they're planting. So they've learned that they have to leave it up about 10 inches or so when they're mowing. They've got to get the cover crop in on time and get the cotton out on time. They've got to manage the weeds in the wintertime as well as in the summertime. So it's a year-round management, and this takes a little bit of getting used to. Another thing is crop rotation. It's something that we've gotten away from because of the way our federal programs are, but it's not new. This is a quote from Will Rogers. And back in 1931, and nothing's changed. We just keep reinventing the wheel. The producers are not going to do what they know is agronomically best if the government programs don't promote crop rotation. So that's something our leaders, again, are failing to do. And finally, an example of what I think, if you put all this together, which can show you the benefit of conservation tillage, is maybe a little tribute to Charlie Mitchell, who I knew when I was at Auburn. He is the caretaker of the old rotation experiment, which is started in 1896, Charlie Mill. And this, if you ever have seen Charlie anywhere, he's going to talk to you about the old rotation experiment and the color rotation. But it was started to grow sustainable cotton. It's about an acre of land. It has a number of rotations, cotton grown every year, either with a legume cover crop or without a legume cover crop. And also with 120 pounds of mineral nitrogen or not. A cotton corn rotation, or two-year rotation they call it, with the winter legume and with the winter legume plus mineral nitrogen. And then a three-year rotation, which is cotton, winter legume, a corn, then a small grain, usually rye or wheat, and followed by soybeans. Now, in 1995, I believe, Dr. Mitchell, you had the centennial of the old rotation, and people from all over the world came to see that experiment. It's the oldest cotton experiment in the world, and I think the third actually oldest experiment in the nation. I think it's second because they actually moved the Magruder plot, soil in Magruder plot, so I think that's cheating. I wanted to kind of do something. We got to talking with Charlie at that centennial, and he agreed and was very enthusiastic about let's change the management system. And we partnered together to change the management system after the centennial to do the next 100 years under conservation tillage, putting all these things together that I was saying are keys to successful conservation tillage. And then, so what I did was look at the the increase in yield from the last 10 years of conventional tillage management from 1986 to 1995, compare that to the first 10 years of this experiment, which was started back in 1896. And over that 100-year period under conventional tillage management, there was a 17% increase in cotton without any nitrogen fertilizer. And that's due to better varieties and a little better weed control. If you put cotton in with a legume, a little more intensive cropping system, more residues, there was about 130% increase in yield during that period, taking advantage of the newer technologies and progress over that 100-year time. Cotton and corn, more residues, more diversity in the rotation, 160-something%. And notice that if we had cotton, corn, and legume, but we added nitrogen, not much of a response there compared just to the cotton and corn. Now, looking at the last 10 years before I got my hands on the data from 1996 to 2005, that was grown with conservation tillage in the manners that we're showing here with the high residue system. We had an increase in everything in all these different rotations, but it's much greater. It's notice that we got the cotton legume. We went up to about 180% with cotton and the winter legume. If we had cotton and corn in the legume, we increased it to about 200%. And then if we threw in extra nitrogen in the white graph, we went over 250% increase compared to the first 10 years. That's taking advantage of Roundup Ready, BT cotton, new technologies, but managing it with the conservation tillage. And by doing that, we can see the advantage that it's going to pay. This system will pay for itself. Finally, a little bit about this Palmer amaranth, the resistance problem. This is something that we've got to get all the agencies. We've got to get the states. We've got to get the extension people. We've got to get Cotton Incorporated. Everybody's got a partner to fight this beast, because this 800-pound gorilla could really set this effort back on conservation tillage. One of the things that I have seen that the weed scientists do not, because we all go in our own separate disciplines and we all congregate birds of a feather, there's less exchange with the people that are dealing with management issues, perhaps. They are not aware of the research that's out there, or else they choose to ignore it, one or the other. The research that's out there that shows the allelopathic and physical effects of residue and mulch and not disturbing the soil with that small seed of Palmer amaranth. This is some work in Brazil that shows the relationship between fresh weight of weeds and the amount of cover crop residue on the soil surface. This is a straight linear decline. This picture up here on the right, in the forefront, up in the front, that's soybean. This is grown without this before Roundup Ready soybean came out. This is soybean with no herbicides at all, grown with a black oak cover crop and drill. And you see there's some escapes of Palmer amaranth in there. If you look behind that, in those plots, that whole field is full of Palmer amaranth. That actually had some herbicides on it, but with no winter cover crop. So you can see that it's not a cure-all, but it's one part, it's a component of a system to try to manage this beast. And it's something that I think that's going to be facing us real quickly here. I'd like to give special thanks to the people that responded to the survey and helped me out with this. Rita Bickle with NRCS in California, and Jeff Mitchell with the Extension Service of California, Kevin Bronson, Lori Zier from NRCS in Texas, Steve Carmichael from Louisiana, Delmer Stamps, and Stanley Mick from Mississippi, Wanda Brosey, Ben Moore from Tiber Horvath, Jay Chapman from Clemson, Steve Boyder from Florida, David Wright from Florida, and Mark Ryder, who's just been hired working with cotton at Virginia. And with that, I'll end it.
We have questions. You do finance statements.
Thank you, Wayne, for that overview, and really it was a pretty inspiring talk. And well, I've known Wayne a long time. He was on my committee when I was at Auburn a few years ago when he was still at Alabama. So do we have any questions for Wayne?
Yes.
I've got a question. You showed a surface with a need for residue across cool, moist, warm, dry, what have you.
Right.
How did you develop that?
It may not be all that accurate. I just actually just developed it myself. I just kind of thought about it. I knew that, for example, where it's wet, and it's cold, like in England, they can produce, with those 100 bushel wheat yields, they can produce so much residue, they have to cart some of it off. And that climate, it wouldn't decompose even if it's there. And then in the arid situations, like in sub-Saharan Africa, the dilemma there is that if you don't have enough, you've got to have the residue to prevent the wind erosion, but if you don't have the water to grow the residue, that's a dilemma. So I just kind of took all those things and just kind of made that graph myself. Randy. I think it's this crisis is the mother of change thing. One thing is that the municipalities, for example, they care because the erosion was so bad it washes out the roads where they don't have a lot of paved roads. So they have a vested interest in it. You know, everybody has a dog in the fight, and we don't have here in the States, we don't have everybody has a dog in the fight. The other thing is driving the input cost down because they don't have as much support for the crop as we do, and they have to manage it and get the input cost down. I agree. I think that we've done a really good job with the researchers out there. Some extension people do a very good job, and some frankly don't. And it's not their fault. They're not encouraged by their leaders. Their deans don't believe in it. The governor of Alabama got out this past summer. No, some before last, prayed for rain on the Capitol steps in the middle of drought. Yet he's ignoring data that's been sent to him at least three times that shows that if the state adopted 75% conservation tillage on the 2.5 million acres or so of cropland that they have in row crops, that they could save as much water in a year. That would be 7 to 20 times all the irrigation amount of water that's used in the state of Georgia. And it would be equal to 1.6 years worth of Greater Atlanta's water use. You know, but they won't put anything in there about in the water bill and they're planning. We water our lawns every other day, based on if your house number is odd or even. But we can't have anything in there to promote conservation tillage. We can't have a tax incentive for a farmer if he buys equipment or moves to it. It's just poor leadership.
Boy, I thought your comment was interesting that in Georgia, where there's center pivots with cotton, that there's less adoption. In West Texas, we're from 500 miles west of here, that's about the only place where you can easily do conservation tillage under the pivot. We have 4 million acres planted within 100 miles of Lubbock, Texas, about half irrigated, half dry land. And again, the irrigated has the opportunity to the cover crop. Of course, it is, mentioned that cotton being low residue, it's hard to get that, although that also changes when your production level goes up. But even us researchers under a pivot have trouble getting that winter cover crop going on a loamy sand in a dry and a very hard environment. But it's not impossible. And we really appreciate your talk today.